Before we dive into today's episode, I wanted to share a free resource that could help you or someone you know wrestle with one of life's biggest questions. Does it make sense to believe in God? This compelling chapter from Why You Can Believe takes on today's top scientific and philosophical objections and reveals three clear reasons why belief in God is entirely rational. Whether you're exploring faith or equipping someone else, it's a must read. And it can be yours today for free. Download your free copy now at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast. Before we dive into today's episode, I wanted to share a free resource that could help you or someone you know wrestle with one of life's biggest questions. Does it make sense to believe in God? This compelling chapter from Why You Can Believe takes on today's top scientific and philosophical objections and reveals three clear reasons why belief in God is entirely rational. Whether you're exploring faith or equipping someone else, it's a must read. And it can be yours today for free. Download your free copy now at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Hello and welcome along to Unbelievable with me, Justin Briley. Yes, it's that time of the week here on Premier Christian Radio when, as part of Faith Explored, we examine the differences between Christians and non-Christians. I've got two great guests to join me for today's show. We recently celebrated our 10th anniversary, of course, on Unbelievable. And later on in the programme, we'll be hearing some of your feedback to the programme I did on that last week, where I read out some of the emails and questions I'd been asked, tried to answer them, and also played some of the best bits from the past 10 years. Don't forget, if you want to get in touch about anything you hear on today's programme, you can email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB or @UnbelievableJB for the Twitter handle. All of those links, past shows, the podcast, resources, videos and much more available from the website of the programme. That's premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Shall we do this?
You're unbelievable.
Well, today on the programme we're asking, why do evangelicals lose their faith and can we improve our Christian persuasion? Two guests and two books under discussion today. Firstly, Rodney Wilson joins me. He's the author of Killing God, Christian Fundamentalism and the Rise of Atheism. It's a book that grew out of his religion degree graduate thesis and includes many interviews with evangelicals in the USA who have lost their faith. Rodney himself lost his faith after growing up and being very active in the church. He'll tell us his story and what his research has revealed about the key reasons that committed evangelical Christians like him, as he was at least, lose their faith. And Oz Guinness is my other guest. Oz, an internationally recognised author and social critic. He works in a public policy think tank out in Washington, D.C., regularly speaks on Christianity and culture, the author of more than 30 books, most recently Fool's Talk, Recovering the Art of Christian Persuasion. And there he sets out his vision for the recovery of Christian persuasion in today's world. So I'm really looking forward to today's programme and both my guests who are joining me. So Rodney, first of all, coming to you, thank you very much for joining me on the programme today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Just tell us a little bit about how your own journey relates to this book that you've recently written.
Well, the first thing I would say is that in the introduction, you said that I have lost my faith. I wouldn't put it that way myself. I was born with a very strong religious orientation. I was born that way. I was not raised in a Christian home. I was not raised with parents who were interested in religion or who were interested in trying to impose any sort of religious belief upon me. But I was interested in religion. So I'd be up on Sunday mornings all alone, the only one awake in the house, watching Jerry Falwell's early 1970s old-time gospel hour. I would be walking down the street to the nearest church to my home, which happened to be a Southern Baptist congregation, and going to Sunday school. I was baptized there when I was 10 years old on a Sunday night of my own accord. My parents weren't present. It was something I wanted to do. So I've always had a very strong religious motivation and a religious orientation, something I always sought out. I ended up in my teens, at age 16, having the classical born-again experience, At this point, I was in an Assembly of God congregation headquartered here in the state I live in, Missouri. It's a Pentecostal organization. It dates its history back to the Azusa Street Revival early in the 20th century. And I became the president of the youth group, Christ Ambassadors. I was planning to be either a preacher or a missionary. I read the King James Bible three times through before I was 21 years old. I would carry the Bible to school with me so that I could read it during timeout times, between classes, during study hall, and so on. I was the way St. Paul wrote about himself as a Pharisee of the Pharisees. I was a Christian of the Christians. I believed in an evangelical, fundamentalist, charismatic, Pentecostal form of Christianity with every fiber in my being. Over time, though, I began to have different theological views than the church I was involved in around issues, one of which being eternal punishment, which I could no longer accept. And I began also to become a bit more liberal in my social understanding of reality. I went away to college, for example. I met my first atheist friend ever in my lifetime, and that was unusual. That opened me up to the fact that there are all sorts of people in the world with all sorts of religions, some without any religions. And then over a period of time into my 20s and 30s, I also began dealing with other issues, one of them being the fact that I am gay. Just as I was born with a religious orientation, I was born with a homosexual orientation. And the dichotomy that it was producing within me, the fact that my church was saying one thing about me and people like me, and my heart and my spirit and my mind were saying something else about people like me, all of that began to create dissonance. And over time, slowly, I drifted away from conservative Christianity into a liberal Christianity. Today, I define myself as still theistically oriented by nature, but deistically oriented by philosophy and the evidence I see in the world, and agnostically oriented in terms of most minutia of religious questions.
Mm. And so with the book that you've written, you sort of went on a quest, really, to discover the reasons that other people who claimed an evangelical faith lost it, or it dropped for whatever reason. And you list, I think, sort of some general areas specifically that would cover, don't you?
Yes, indeed. In getting my graduate degree, of course, I had to pick a thesis, and it first was going to be on Jehovah's Witnesses and some of the changes in their prophecies, specifically the 1914, this generation will not pass the idea, but I dropped that. And then I was going to do one on post-apocalyptic, imminent return of Christ, Hal Lindsey, late great planet Earth, 1970s, 1980s. I wrote a paper on it, but it wasn't enough. Then I came upon this idea of looking at individuals who, at one point, believed with all of their hearts, who trusted in Jesus, who were evangelical or fundamentalist Christians, who believed the Bible, and now they don't. I encountered many of these on the internet at places like xchristian.net, for example. And I became intrigued by the process whereby one deconverts. I'm always interested in people who make fundamental shifts in their paradigm or life philosophy or worldview. So I wanted to know, why did these individuals go from being true believers, who truly believed in Jesus, who truly believed in the Bible, who truly believed in the message of Christianity, and now they are agnostic or atheist? What were the factors that were involved in that progression in their beliefs about faith and religion, and even specifically their own particular Christian denomination?
Mm. Well, we won't have time to spell out all of those, but we will certainly aim to cover a couple of them in the first part of today's program. And we'll come back to you in a moment, Rodney, because I must introduce my other guest on the program today. Oz Guinness joins me again. It was over a year ago that you were on the show, Oz, but in between times you were also with me for Unbelievable the Conference in 2014, which was a great event, and so many listeners will be familiar with your voice and perhaps your face as well. you're pretty prolific though when it comes to books, as far as I can tell, and your most recent one, Fool's Talk: Recovering the Art of Christian Persuasion. What's made you want to write about this specifically, Oz?
Well, a lot of Christians are simply unpersuasive. In other words, the Christian consensus in Europe and also in America more recently has broken down. So many Christians got used to, you might call, speaking Christian, and people would understand them even if they weren't Christians, but that's gone. And now public life is incredibly secular and private life is incredibly diverse with all the religions of the world. Mm. Everyone is now everywhere. And so Christians have got to be able to speak in ways that make sense to people of all sorts of different worldviews and faiths, and above all, to people who are not open, not interested, not needy.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look particularly in America, the church is filled with recipes and formulae and 1-2-3-4 style of evangelism, assuming everyone's open, but they simply aren't.
Uh-huh.
And so how do we speak to people not open, not interested, not needy? And persuade, it requires persuasion. That's what the book's about.
What are some of the general principles that you draw out? It's a very in-depth book. It's and a lot of, in a sense, scholarly work. But what's the practical outworking for you of some of these things?
Well, if you look in the Bible, for example, and the best communicators down the centuries, when people are open, evangelism in its simplest and most straightforward is appropriate. But when they're not, you have to be subversive, indirect, roundabout. For example, the use of questions rather than statements, or stories rather than discursive arguments, and so on. So the book is describing how they work and how we can begin to use those.
I mean, it's worth saying, in a sense, that this book is written for Christians, in a sense. It's not an apologetic in itself. But one of the things you do say is that we're all apologists now in the age
Christians.
Of websites, blogs, Twitters, Facebook,
oh,
and so on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in a sense, everyone has a platform. Everyone has, you know,
the daily me.
Exactly. That's the way you put it. So do you think that has shifted the way in which we do Christian persuasion?
That comment came from a secular article that said this is the great age of apologetics. Christians have been at it for 2,000 years, and yet we've sort of got out of the way of doing it well, and that's what we need to recover. And so apologetics has become something for philosophers or eggheads. And I don't think the book is scholastic. It's actually going back to biblical ways of doing
things,
many of which are relatively simple.
Well, thank you very much. We're going to sort of dig into the book a bit later in the program. But if you're interested in getting in touch yourself about anything you hear on the show today, it'd be lovely to hear from you as well. Wherever you stand on the faith issue, the faith spectrum, why not email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Don't forget, you can also find Unbelievable as a Facebook page, a Twitter account, as a blog, and much more besides. If you want links to that, simply go to the show webpage, premierchristianradio.com/Unbelievable. There's today's show and many more besides. We're coming up to our 10th anniversary, believe it or not, soon. And later on in the programme, I'm going to be reminding you that you can write in, and I will attempt to answer any question you send me on our 10th anniversary programme in a couple of weeks' time. So make sure to do that as well, if you're able. But today we're talking about why evangelicals lose their faith and whether we can improve our Christian persuasion.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, I'll come back to you, Rodney, as we dig into a couple of the reasons that you outlined from these interviews that you had with, I think, over 1,000 sort of deconverts. It's useful to have Oz here because Oz spends a lot of his time both in the States and the UK. And one of the things that you outlined in the book was one of the reasons for which people are leaving the faith is that conservative Christianity, you say, has morphed into an arm of the Republican Party, standing self-righteously against political beliefs that often don't match the general populations in that sense. So this view is one of the significant issues for why you feel people are leaving the church.
Yes, indeed it is. I'm reminded of Alexis de Tocqueville, who was that great Frenchman who visited the United States in the antebellum period, the 1830s, and he was amazed by the heightened religiosity of the American people. But he also commented on the fact that the American clergy, quote, stand aloof from secular affairs. And he said because they stand aside from the rough and tumble of the political world, they are given great esteem, and they have their area of say and their area of authority, and people listen to them, sort of the Stephen Jay Gould non-overlapping magisteria, except not with science and religion, but with politics and religion. And it seems that that paradigm remained constant in American history, even through the 1950s, when indeed we did become more religious as we opposed godless communism in the Soviet Union, rightfully a very grave and serious threat to the human race and to freedom and Western civilization. But even then, every American probably liked Eisenhower, who was president for 8 years in the 1950s. But something changed then. In the 1970s, we became a nation in which there was more strident religious fundamentalism and a more strident desire among some religious to impose their particular theological views and theological opinions upon the body politic and upon the government. Jumping to mind very quickly would be the 1977-78 Anita Bryant gay rights battles, the Briggs Initiative in California, the founding of the Moral Majority with Jerry Falwell in 1979, the rise of Pat Robertson and the Christian Coalition, and a hyper-partisan and hyper-religious nature of politics. Mm.
There have been Rodney?
Yes.
You know, I've actually written a book on it, too. And I agree with much of what you're saying. There is a politicized faith in the religious right, the Christian right, which has betrayed the gospel. But I don't think that's a reason to give up the faith itself. In England, we had the phenomenon of the Tory party on its knees, and that's what conservatism was, and so on. In America, you have a much more belligerence, and certainly they've made a couple of huge mistakes. One, to politicize the gospel. Two, to fight what they're fighting in non-Christian ways, trying to do the Lord's work, but in the world's way. But when all that is said, I've critiqued it. People like James Davison Hunter have critiqued it. But at the end of the day, critiquing what's wrong is not a reason to give up the faith.
What's your take on that?
I think that's a very good point that you make, because indeed we cannot judge an entire people or an entire denomination or an entire religion by what some do. But it seems particularly pernicious today, the radical right, as some call it, and its involvement with the political party of the Republican Party seems particularly bad. You might have caught this past weekend, for example, there was a National Religious Liberties Conference hosted by Kevin Swanson, who's a preacher out of Colorado. Mike Huckabee and Bobby Jindal and Ted Cruz, who are three of the men running for the nomination of the political party, were there. And during that same weekend, that same preacher talked about what he would do if he had a gay son who invited him to come to a wedding. He said he would go to the church, he would sit outside the church in sackcloth and ashes, he would sit in cow dung, he would rub the cow dung all over his body.
Rodney, now, but this is dramatic stuff, but it's not a reason to give up the faith. Who is the toughest counter-hypocrisy critic in all history, human history? Jesus. Jesus.
Yes.
He had no time or patience with hypocrites, whited sepulchres, etc. So at the end of the day, I would criticize what you're criticizing, but it confirms the reality of the real thing. Sadly, there's a lot of counterfeit. But here's a point I'd make generally. Justin, we're in a clarifying moment in the U.S. It happened in England in the 60s. Mm. You were either a Christian and you knew who you believed, why you believed, what you believed, or you left it. And that clarifying went through the European church 40 years ago. It's now going through America. And generally speaking, Rodney, as you know well, the so-called rise of the religious nuns, N-O-N-E-S, most of the nuns are the old nominals who now hitch their wagon to secularism rather than faith. But there are many, but they're a minority, who you describe well, who really had a somewhat, let me put it bluntly, inadequate faith. In other words, if you have a faith like some of the things you're describing, Who would believe that if they're really intellectually serious? So you've got to really know who you believe with deep experience, but why you believe what you believe in ways that stand the muster of tough questions.
I mean, Rodney, from your perspective, did you felt that the kind of theology, I suppose, that you were given when you were in your learning phase, I suppose, as a Christian, was not adequate for what you then went into, obviously, when you went to college and so on. It all started to unravel and break down in many ways. I don't know whether that's a story you've heard a lot from other, you know, ex-Christians as well.
I
know that I certainly hear that. And one of the other points you brought up was the inadequacy, you say, of various apologetic arguments regarding suffering, famine, cancer, all those sorts of things, and the one you struggled with of the doctrine of hell as well. So has this been a significant thing in the stories of many people you've interviewed?
It has been, and these have been individuals. While I interviewed almost 1,600 people, almost 400 people had been formerly conservative, fundamentalist, true-believing Christians. And while I agree with Oz that we cannot judge the Christian religion or the ministry of Jesus on the basis of those who claim to be following Jesus, we cannot do that. Yet it does seem that when over and over and over those who are claiming to be followers of Jesus, those who are claiming to represent Jesus, come off with the most bizarre and asinine arguments and concerns about their own, in the United States, persecution, eventually you begin to wonder, is there anything about them that's different? They claim to believe in a God of love. They claim to believe in a God who is love. They claim to believe in a God who so loved the world he sent his only begotten Son. Yet all I'm seeing reflected back at me from at least those who get the attention of the cameras and the news media is anything but love.
Yeah, but
and
again,
over time, you...
Rodney, you're referring again to them, and you and I would probably agree pretty strongly on some of the asinine, idiotic, anti-intellectual positions they take. But, you know, we're in a time when, sadly, much of the Western Church, compared, say, with Africa or Asia, where I grew up, much of the Western Church is shallow, it's corrupt, it's very close to the conditions just before the Reformation, when the church was a savage caricature of what it's supposed to be. There's a famous story from Oxford of Thomas Lineker, who could read Greek. Of course, in those days, only the clergy had the Bible, but he was given the four Gospels. He read them in the original, and he handed them back to the priest who lent it to him, and he said, either these are not the Gospels, or we're not Christians. And, of course, that led to the Reformation long afterwards. And we need a Reformation in the church today. But, of course, everything you pile up on the evidence that poor Christians, you know, is against Jesus.
And there are many more examples that I'm sure could be added in that sense of poor examples of people claiming to represent Christ. I mean, we had that whole thing, didn't we, recently about someone's video complaining that Starbucks have taken the Christmas off their red cups going viral. And everyone sort of piling on that because it's another Christian apparently being silly. But what you said there, though, Rodney, struck me, which is that unfortunately it's just a facet of our media age that it's often those voices that tend to be given the most prominence. It's the Westboro Baptist churches and so on, who are a tiny bunch of 20 people all from the same family, but they get a disproportionate amount of media time. But does that influence the way many people think about Christianity realistically, Rodney?
I think it absolutely does, but then we also have to dig a little bit deeper that while the Westboro Baptist Church, we all agree, is a hateful and mean-spirited organization, they do have a lot of Bible verses they can quote. Leviticus 18, Leviticus 21, Romans chapter 1, 1 Corinthians chapter 6, and I noticed in Dr. Guinness's book, he references Romans 1 often when talking about those who suppress the truth and unrighteousness. And he mentions, in fact, the bullying is the word that was used of the LGBT community and how this is a threat to Christian faith. So not only is it that there are individuals who sometimes can be mean-spirited, not that Dr. Guinness is, I've never encountered or seen a mean-spirited bone in his body, but there are scriptures in the Bible that the modern world simply cannot accept. We cannot accept that LGBT people should be put to death, like the author of Leviticus said. We can accept.
But Rodney, you know that was never the New Testament position, never the position of Jesus. Again, you're quoting things. I'll let the Jewish people defend how they understand that. But you're quoting things that aren't relevant to giving up the faith. Now, when you mention things like suffering, you mentioned, Justin, well, that's much, much deeper. And I think the two greatest objections to the Christian faith today, one is hypocrisy, and that's what you majored on, essentially. The other is evil. I wrote a book on evil. I grew up in a very evil culture in China. My two brothers died there, and so on. But I would say, in all my explorations of evil, take, say, Holocaust studies, it was atheist intellectuals who couldn't handle the deepest challenges of evil. Many of them committed suicide. So evil is an incredible challenge to anybody, certainly to the Christian faith. But I know no deeper, more profound answer than the Christian answer. So, you know, that's the sort of reason to really wrestle with, not the behavior of wretched American Christians when they abandon the gospel any more than wretched European Christians.
I mean, let's turn to this issue of suffering then. Just we've got a couple more minutes in this section of the program before we have to take a quick break. But did you find that this theological question of suffering was the thing that was, as it were, the thing that drove people away from the faith very often in your experience, Rodney?
Yes, indeed. In fact, I'm reminded there of Bart Ehrman's book, God's Problem, How the Bible Fails to Answer Our Most Important Question, Why We Suffer. And he says forthrightly that though while there were many things that contributed to his eventually walking away from being a sincere, honest, conservative Christian who believed in Jesus, who loved the Bible, among the reasons was the lack of adequate explanations for wickedness and evil in the world. It was the reason I lost my faith, is what he writes. And I did find that in my research, because we do not have an adequate explanation for evil. I listened to your program a few weeks back, Justin, in which there was the warfare thesis and the blueprint thesis. Neither, in my view, adequately would explain or describe why there is evil and wickedness in the world. There were those who reported to me when I did my study that one of them had a newborn who was sick and died, and someone said to her, well, this must be some sort of generational sin. And then when there was that terrible tsunami at Christmas time in 2004, someone reported that someone said to them, you know, I wonder what they did that made God so angry. And then
whoever said that was appalling.
Well, I mean, what you're describing again, I suppose, is the fact that people get given bad theology a lot of the time. Now, of course, I guess we can sit here and say something's bad because we think we've got a better theology. But I mean, let's carry this conversation on in a moment, Rodney, and we'll see what Oz has to say in response in just a moment's time. We've come to the end of the first part of today's show. We're having a good conversation today. Rodney Wilson, who's the author of Killing God, Christian Fundamentalism and the Rise of Atheism, which charts the loss of faith of many evangelicals that he interviewed in the course of doing his graduate thesis. He's on conversation today with Oz Guinness, who's an internationally recognised author and social critic. And his book, too, is going to be covered as well in our conversation, Fool's Talk, Recovering the Art of Christian Persuasion. They're my guests today, Justin Brierley, with you today for Unbelievable, here on Premier Radio as part of Faith Explored. Did you know Christmas is the most likely time that someone will say yes to an invitation to church? So why do so few Christians invite their friends? In the latest Premier Christianity magazine, we explore the 12 nays of Christmas, the most common reasons people give for not inviting, and practical advice on how to overcome our fears. Also this month, hear stories of help, healing and hope at the Church for Refugees in Lebanon, and the world's greatest living explorer, Sir Ranulph Fiennes, chats to us about his faith in some of the most remote locations on earth. Get your free copy now at premierchristianity.com/freesample.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to today's programme. Here on Unbelievable, we often bring Christians and non-Christians together. It's really the bread and butter of the show. We encourage interesting, stimulating dialogue and debate, and we hope to make you think in the process. And if you'd like to get in touch about today's programme or anything you hear in the course of the show, why not email in? You can find me on Twitter and Facebook as well. So the ways to email are unbelievable@premier.org.uk, and we'll hear some of your feedback towards the end of today's show. But you can also tweet me at unbelievablejb if you'd like to follow me on Twitter. facebook.com/unbelievablejb is the Facebook address, and you can follow the show there and more besides. Now, my guests today on the programme are Rodney Wilson and Oz Guinness. Rodney is, I think he's described himself as agnostic in some respects, deist in other respects, leaning towards theism as well. So he's certainly not an out-and-out atheist, but he has interviewed a variety of people who have lost their faith in one way or another. Perhaps they had a very strong evangelical faith, but it fell away. And we've talked about some of the reasons for that already in the programme. So he joins me along with Oz Guinness today. Oz's latest book, Fool's Talk, Recovering the Art of Christian Persuasion, available now via IVP. I'll make sure there are links to both my guests and the books that we've been talking about on the programme today. But today, discussing simply why some people do lose their faith and whether we can improve our Christian persuasion at the same time. And Oz we were both hearing from you, Rodney, some of the poor reasons sometimes that people are given for why they might, God may have allowed suffering and so on. As far as you're concerned, it sounded like you were saying, Rodney, whether good, we judge them good or bad, you don't feel there is an adequate response to that, you know, age-old question, you know, the question that was asked by Job, the very earliest book that was written down in the Old Testament. So for you, that question would need to be satisfactorily answered before you could approach Christian theism again. Is that the case?
I think there is a satisfactory answer, and it's the one that I came to some time ago, starting with when I read Rabbi Harold Kushner's book, When Bad Things Happen to Good People. It was written after the death of his son at age 14, who had rapid aging syndrome. And Rabbi Kushner was trying to understand, how did this terrible thing happen to this innocent soul, my son? How did this happen to my family? And Rabbi Kushner eventually came to the point that the idea we have, or the understanding we have about the omnipotence of God, is a weak or immature or primitive type understanding. And that's what I came to. I don't think that God is involved in trying to help us find parking spots or pass a test. I don't think that God gets involved with helping us cure a terrible disease. I think these are all things that just happen or don't happen. For me, and this is where I'm deistically inclined, I see God now as a great scientist who put this into motion, this great experiment. We are, in effect, laboratories in a rat called planet, or rats in a laboratory called planet Earth, and God is just watching what happens. I just don't believe that teaching that an interventionist God is ever present and ever ready and at our beck and call to fix everything that is wrong and to solve all the world's evil is healthy. And I think teaching things like that sets a lot of people up for obvious and very quick disappointment when what happens to them is inconsistent with that worldview.
Hmm. Okay, you've spelled it out very well, Oz.
Yeah, but again, Rodney, you're giving a bit of a caricature. I would agree with you when you're talking about parking place theology and things like that. But put it like this. I thought at the deeper level, Rabbi Kushner's book was profoundly inadequate. In essence, he's answering what used to be called the trilemma. A dilemma has two horns, and a trilemma has three. And the three are this: is evil really evil? Is God all good? And is God all powerful? Well, the obvious way out of that is to relax one of them. Evil is terribly evil. His son has rapid aging disease. I've read it too. God is all good, but he's not up to it. He's not all powerful. He relaxes the third. The Bible never does, as you know well. My own view would be that you take all three seriously. Evil is evil, God is all good, and God is all-powerful, but not an interventionist God like you're caricaturing. The Bible gives each of those points a little twist which turns them from the dilemma into an assurance. So is evil evil? Absolutely. But it should have been otherwise. Atheists, you can't change anything. The world is as it is. There's no change. As Camus says, never-ending defeat. Existence is the error. That leads to a heartless view of life. The second one is God all good? Absolutely. And no other God has wounds. He comes, he suffers. And great, great thinkers like Dostoevsky, that was the final clincher. But the third one takes a bit more time to say. But in the famous parable of Basil Mitchell, the resistance leader knows what he's doing. And if you've ever read Basil Mitchell's parable, it satisfied even the tough atheists like J.L. Mackey and the sort of new atheists of the 1950s. So I think there are profound answers to that. And I think your view of a deistic universe ends you with a heartless God who's really cruel if he's just watching us suffer in that way. That's not the biblical view. God comes down in the Exodus to deliver his people. Justice matters. Our Lord was angry at the tomb of Lazarus, his friend, and so can we be.
Rodney, what do you say?
I think so. I think that for me, God seems more cruel if God has the power to make a change, if God has the power to empty cancer wards that are full of children, if God has the power to stop disease and suffering and war and doesn't. That makes me question the motives of God. If I view God as someone who is outside the framework, someone who's looking in a white lab coat to see what's happening,
I actually
understand that type of God better. That type of God doesn't seem as potentially cruel to me.
That isn't the God who's the father of Jesus. And Rodney, here's a story I may have told Justin before. In the 60s, when I was living with Francis Schaeffer, there was a famous American Christian leader whose son was killed in a cycling accident in Paris. And he came over, and we heard the news. He preached at his son's funeral with great faith, Romans 8:28, all things work together for good, and so on. Schaeffer heard the account, the story, and he said, I hope he felt the same thing inside. 3 weeks later, we got a call. Could this great man come and talk to Schaeffer? Of course, yes, and I remember introducing them. 5 minutes later, the rest of us in the chalet left it. Swiss chalets have rather thin walls that are made of wood. And you could hear this, quote, great Christian leader cursing and blaspheming. Why did God take his son? Etc. And later that night, I asked Schaeffer what sort of line he took in reply. And he said, we just read together John 11. Because everyone knows that, the shortest verse in the Bible, Jesus wept. Many people miss the fact there are two Greek words repeated three times. Jesus was furious. He was outraged. And I just love that, and so did the Father in this case. In other words, when you look at Jesus, you see God's face wet with tears, God's face flushed with anger, because it should have been otherwise. There was a time it wasn't this way. There will be a time it won't be this way. And those who follow him are supposed to be in the forefront of fighting against evil, for justice, etc., etc. Nothing like the heartless cruelty of a God who watches in a lab coat.
We're not going to resolve the problem of evil in this episode of the program. But Rodney, I understand that you obviously would probably want to come back again. The reality is, though, whether or not you agree with Oz's take on that, do you feel like the problem you've outlined here, that more evangelicals would retain their faith if churches were more willing to engage with these questions and perhaps give the kind of answers that Oz gives, or do you think, you know, that churches simply have to abandon their view of an interventionist God and become deists like yourself? That's the only route that you can see, I suppose.
I think there are several ways in which the church can be made better. And in fact, there's a chapter in the back of the book called Dear John Letters to the Church, in which these former true believing Christians give advice or recommendation to the church. And I do think the church can do all sorts of things around, for example, not setting up such high expectations about what inerrancy of Scripture is, and not being so in opposition to the findings of science and the ideas about evolution, abandoning conservative politics, being more open about the whole idea of theodicy and that we don't really understand it, because currently we do live in a world that is cruel and in a world in which there is great suffering, in a world in which ISIS is doing what it's doing in the Middle East. So that is the world we have. It is a world that appears as though God is not intervening. God is not giving every member of ISIS a heart attack to get them off our planet. So when very good, honest, kind, faithful people approach these various topics and approach the question of theodicy and come away with it simply unable to believe in an interventionist God or even in a God who's the father of Jesus, I think that is also deserving in the Christian world of a place of honor and a place of respect. It doesn't mean that all of their thinking is messed up, or it doesn't mean that all human thinking is idolatrous, and I'm quoting from Oz's book there, or that all human thinking is hypocritical, or that all human thinking is sinful, or that Romans 1 infects us all so deeply that we can't think logically.
We're moving into the territory of Oz's book, so let's
pick up
that.
One thing you've said several times, Rodney. You said true believing Christians. The way you're saying it sounds as if you're saying people who are devotedly sincere, whereas true believing for me is those who really believe in the truth of the faith and have a solid intellectual understanding of why they believe. And that's been missing in what you said. I mean, in other words, does the church need reformation? Absolutely. But 90% of what you described, I would agree with. There's an incredible lot of asininity around. Of course we should be in... Where did modern science come from? The Reformation. Isaac Newton. People like Francis Collins today. Christians are in favor of science. Of course, of course, of course. So 90% of what you said, I agree with. But that doesn't in any way undermine the truthfulness of the Christian faith.
Well, let's talk about Oz's book a bit, because you've read the book yourself, Rodney, in advance of today's program. And as I say, it wasn't in a sense aimed at the book at non-Christians anyway. But it's good, to get a perspective, because the book is about persuading how we can, as a Christian community, recover the art, as you call it, of Christian persuasion, Oz. Now, that takes all kinds of different forms in the book. But you, one of the things you raised in early on in your reading of it, Rodney, was whether there's even a need to evangelize in 2015. You say, why learn these tricks of the religious trade? Why learn how to be a better apologist? Why learn good techniques? Well, is that what you're aiming at with this book, first of all, Oz? And then we'll let Rodney come in.
No, I've got a chapter on the devil's bait, I even call it, relying on technique. Now, I think Christian persuasion must be shaped by the good news of Jesus himself and supremely in the cross. So it's not a matter of techniques that work. And that's one of the lures of today. Everything's reduced to technique.
The five-point plan to getting someone to accept Jesus Christ sort of thing. Why did you feel then that was a sort of where Oz's book is pointing, Rodney?
Well, it did seem to me early on it was more about technique. I agree that as the book continued, it became much less about that. But it would seem to me that the very best thing Christians can do to attract people to their particular belief or ideology is to love their neighbor. Love of neighbor, love of others, living out 1 Corinthians chapter 13, living out what Jesus said in John chapter 13 about they will know you are my disciples if you love one another. I think love should be the emphasis always. The greatest of these is love. Everything else will fall, but love will remain. And Christians, instead of this or that or the other technique or having a mega church that looks like a rock concert, if they would simply learn to love one another openly, all people, excluding no one, welcoming everyone to come and dine, I think that is the way for Christianity to continue to survive and for Christianity to continue to be attractive in the marketplace of ideas.
Well, Rodney, I'd say bravo. Absolutely. But not because Christians want to continue to survive, but because Christians want to be faithful to their master, to Jesus. What you were saying is what he called them to do, to love. But he also had love and truth, and Jesus spoke bluntly. And he called his followers to share the faith. In other words, if you look at the gospel, there's certain things that are true of all of us who are Christians. To know and love him, we're called to live his way, including love, and we're called to share the faith with others so they come to know him the way we know him. And so, yes, love, absolutely, and love is the final apologetic. It is the deepest thing. Tell me your story. We've got again. Schaefer was brilliant at this. He'd say, in effect, tell me your story. And he'd talk to people 2 or 3 minutes. You could see his eyes welling with tears because he was so empathetic, loving the person. Of course, whether they're straight or gay or whatever, continent or whatever, it has to start and end with love. Of course. But that doesn't rule out sharing the faith.
Yeah, I mean, are you against, in that sense, doing more than simply loving people? Do you think that actual evangelization, you know, telling people the good news of Jesus Christ, is that something you have a problem with, Rodney?
I think that it is certainly acceptable to do so. I once did it many times. I went door to door. I tried to convert this person and that person. I brought my mother and my father and my grandmother and my sister and my best friend into the church when I was born again myself. So I understand that particular motivation and desire, and I do know that Jesus said in the Great Commission, go into all the world and preach the gospel, and I definitely think there's a place for that.
And you, it sounds like you were fairly persuasive yourself. You had some success by the sounds of it.
I did have a lot of success, and I think that there is a great message that can be preached in love, and I think that spreading good news about love is so important. What bothers me is that often I see some modern Christians, Dr. Guinness obviously is not one of these, I see some modern Christians who are more caught up in the condemnation and the judgment and the belittling. If, just as an anecdote, when I'm on Facebook having a conversation and it gets really hot and heavy, sadly, some of the most odd and mean-spirited comments, when I look at that person's Facebook page, they also believe in God, they believe in Jesus, they're supporters of the Republican Party, and once again it just says to me, wow, there is something terribly missing here, because everything should be grounded in love. Everything we say, oh,
absolutely.
Everything we do.
Absolutely. Now, sadly, some Christians are the best argument for atheism. And that's a sad thing. And you can go back to the late medieval time, in the so-called age of dissimulation, when people who didn't believe in God had to pretend they did because it wasn't worth their life not to. And you can see today that it's religion that's caused the new atheism. Richard Dawkins says quite openly it was 9/11 which set him off with the stridency of what he's doing. And sadly, many Christians, if you look at France, the corruptions of the established church. You know the famous saying, we want to strangle the last king with the guts of the last priest. The revolution threw out both church and state, and understandably. And if you look at America, part of the rise of the religious nuns is a reaction to the ugliness of the Christian right. They have tried to do the Lord's work, but in the world's way, demonizing their enemies. And it's boomeranging back on the church. But they're corrupt. You're right. I'm with you.
Okay. Quite a lot of agreement in that sense. But, I mean, what about this?
But no reason for giving up the faith.
Well, let's bring up something else that you bring in here, Rodney. What did you want to say about this? When Oz says far too much Christian evangelism and apologetics is based on the assumption that almost everyone is open, interested and needy, when most people, most of the time, are quite simply not. Now, you say, well, if most people are not needy or not interested, why the need for Christian apologists and evangelists to try to sell them their product? So again, on this issue of evangelism, do you feel like if people are not asking you, you know, what must I do to be saved, that the Christians have no business trying to persuade them? They should just be let alone to their own devices. Where's this criticism come from, Rodney?
I think Christians have every right to do whatever it is they wish to do in their churches, in their families, in their communities. This is not a problem whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
But we have so much religious tension in the world today.
Mm.
And currently, among some conservative Christians in the United States especially, there is a growing desire for some sort of holy war against Islam, which would only bring on another conflagration in world history.
But Rodney, you remember President Reagan? He kept saying to Jimmy Carter, "There you go again." Now, as you're just saying,
yes,
there are an ugly extreme there. That's true. But you're not talking about the real thing, my dear friend. You're not talking about the real thing.
I would agree with you that it certainly does not seem to be the real thing, because the real thing would mean that the Holy Spirit indwelling a person would transform the person. The mind would be transformed, the way St. Paul said.
That's
so
right.
Perhaps this isn't artificial Christianity that's masquerading for the real thing, but it is what people see. It is what we find in our news feed on Facebook. It is what we see on the television. So maybe there needs to be a big internal discussion among all people who claim to be of the Christian faith about how they can go about living out the teachings of Jesus better.
Absolutely.
How they can go about loving their neighbor better.
Many of us are openly praying for Reformation revival because we need it across the church. But, you know, I mentioned Schaefer earlier. I was at the Labrie community. We had hundreds, if not thousands, of people who are coming as dropouts from bad churches and colleges where they were anti-intellectual and so on. And they were giving faith a second chance because they saw a real community with lots of love. And they heard honest answers to honest questions. And they realized if you consider the Christian faith, is it true? And then seeing that, what's its answers to some of the profound questions of life? Many, many people came back to faith. And I would hope if you and I were able to get together sometime, we could talk to the point we really trust each other, clear up a lot of the stuff. A lot of things you mentioned today are not relevant to whether the Christian faith is true and so on. That's the key question.
I mean, what about this issue, though, that Rodney does raise there, Oz, which is why would you want to try and reach people who are not open, interested, or needy?
Well, put it this way, Justin. You know, Martin Heidegger, one of the greatest philosophers, if not the greatest of the 20th century, his posthumous essay said famously, "Only a God can save us now." Now, he hadn't become a Christian. But surveying modern philosophy, modern challenges, technology, environmental, all sorts of things, his conviction was that the problems were so deep we needed help from outside ourselves. Now, if that's true for philosopher looking at the global issues, it's true of millions of ordinary individuals who are facing situations they need answers.
Mm.
And the gospel is good news. It really is an answer. Once you know its adequacy and its truthfulness together, it's an answer. It's good news to people who are in a bad situation.
Even if they don't know that that's the answer they are looking for.
Absolutely.
We have a responsibility to, as it were, make them hungry,
yeah.
I suppose.
I met one of the leading gay activists in America. He had very few teeth in the front of his face because the police in New York had knocked them out in parades.
Right.
And he was one of the leaders of ACT UP.
Mm.
And he just come very close to faith, and then he became a Christian.
Mm.
And I said to him, "What was it?" He said, "Well, I was at the Clinton Foundation, the Global Foundation, and this huge teddy bear of a man in the cocktail hour put his arm around me and just said, 'David, tell me a story.'"
Mm-hmm.
He said, "An hour later, I was telling him my story, and I realized the first man in my life who'd loved me and listened to me." And then he said, "I realized to my horror, it was a pastor, Rick Warren." You know, and there are many people, they don't think the faith. They've got all the ideas that Rodney has said so well, and I agree with him on the critique. But there are people who, they really are in a bad situation in the modern world, and they need good news, rightly shared.
We've just got a couple of minutes left on this section of the program, Rodney. Anything else you wanted to bring up before we sort of go to our final section that sparked your interest or your concern in Oz's book as well?
I think I was a bit concerned in a particular chapter in which he is talking about Romans chapter 1, and he brings up the threat that he, in this language, the bullying agenda of the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer coalition. And in that same paragraph, he references Martin Luther, and then he references Martin Niemöller's talking about how there wasn't enough opposition early on to National Socialism. Anytime I see Nazi and homosexuality in the same paragraph, it makes me want a clarification.
Of course.
So I'm curious as to what Dr. Guinness does believe about human beings like myself who were born with a religious orientation and a homosexual orientation.
Well, I would say, don't get that paragraph, chapter out of context. The main thing is about suppressing the truth. And I'm using people like Aldous Huxley and others to illustrate how people do that. That's the main part. It's not about Romans 1 and homosexuality. But in terms of the gay issue, you're like any of us. If someone is a heterosexual or a homosexual, we all have temptations that come from our orientation. In today's hookup culture, for instance, the heterosexual has just as much to renounce of lifestyle as, say, someone in the gay style does. And it's certainly equally bad. And I would just say we're people that God loves. You're a person that God loves. Every gay, every straight person is. Your sexual orientation will never be your complete identity. You're bigger and more wide than that. So, yes, that's the challenge you have. I might have the challenge on the other side. And, you know, the temptations to pornography, to promiscuity, and all the things that the heterosexuals do today. You know, to take up my cross and follow Jesus, you might have to say no to certain things. I have to say no to a lot of things, too. And so it's not, as you say, Pastor Fred Phelps. He's horrendous. He's horrendous, and I agree with you on that. We would both have to pick up our cross and follow Jesus, but in doing so, we'd find a joy and a fulfillment. Out of the sacrifice would come joy.
We're going to take a break, and I will allow you to respond, Rodney, because we're just out of time in this section, and we'll come back for a final part of the programme. My guests today on Unbelievable are Oz Guinness and Rodney Wilson. We've been talking about why evangelicals lose their faith, and latterly, whether we can improve the art of Christian persuasion. That's the subtitle of Oz's book, Fool's Talk. So I do hope you can join me for the final part of today's programme. This is Justin Brierley bringing you your weekly dose of dialogue and discussion here on Unbelievable. Welcome back to the final part of this week's Unbelievable. I'm Justin Brierley, your host for the programme that aims to bring different points of view together every single week. And as I mentioned earlier and have in the last couple of shows, we've celebrated our 10th anniversary of the programme. And a lot of you, after last week's show, in which I did a special roundup of what's happened on Unbelievable over the years and tried to answer as many of your questions as possible, have sent in your congratulations as well. So we'll get to some of those in the course of the rest of the programme. Later on here on Premier, if you continue to listen to Faith Explored through 4 and 5pm today, you can hear The Profile. And Sam Hales today meets the great-grandson of Winston Churchill, Jonathan Sandys, and he's the author of a new book on Churchill's faith. So listen out for that between 4 and 5 this Saturday afternoon. Next week here on Unbelievable, we're going to be talking about something that came out quite recently. This was the Commission on Religion and Belief in British Public Life, which recommended sweeping reforms of the role of Christianity in public life. It hasn't gone down well with all parts of the church. But we'll be asking in the programme next week, are we finished with Britain's Christian heritage? And a very exciting guest for that, Peter Hitchens, will be joining me. I know that we had one person asking at least last week on the programme, when are you getting Peter Hitchens on again? Well, hopefully that'll be this time next week. And you'll have to wait, as we are still in the process of arranging who the other participant might be. But look out for that at the same time next week. And of course, online at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
So as we conclude today's programme, and my guests Rodney Wilson and Oz Guinness, if you want to find any more detail about them both, well, you can certainly go online and look them up, but I'll make sure that there are links to both their books and where you can find out more about them at the website. That's premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. for today's programme. You can even leave your thoughts below today's show. Quite a few people do comment from week to week underneath the show itself and leave their thoughts there. So feel free to do that as well. Just a reminder that Rodney is the author of Killing God, Christian Fundamentalism and the Rise of Atheism. It's a book that grew out of his graduate thesis, includes many interviews with people who lost their faith. And that was, to some extent, Rodney's story, though he wouldn't describe himself as an atheist today. He'd say that certainly his conception of God has changed a lot since he was a Christian at one time. Oz Guinness is very familiar and used to speaking in all kinds of different contexts to both Christian and secular audiences. His latest book, though, very much aimed at the Christian community, and it's entitled Fool's Talk, Recovering the Art of Christian Persuasion, and we've been talking about that just as we were concluding the last part of the show, gentlemen. Rodney, you were going to respond to what Oz was saying there in the last section, which is simply his view that whether heterosexual or homosexual, we all, the Christian gospel calls us all to certain standards, and that and in that sense we all have to I suppose in Christian terms live in line with those standards or attempt to live as best we can. So what was your response going to be, Robert?
I think that's perfectly fine that we have equal standards, because I believe that all individuals should be equal under the law and equal under heaven. So if we have the same constraints upon the ways in which we live our lives, I think that's perfectly acceptable. Many young people, the evidence is very clear with a Pew Research study, with what I did, with what others have done, young people overwhelmingly no longer differentiate between their heterosexual friends and their bisexual or homosexual friends. And young people overwhelmingly are being turned off by sermons from pulpits that are condemnatory of their gay and lesbian friends, family members, and neighbors. So I'd be curious to know what Dr. Guinness thinks the church might want to do to walk a better line between maintaining the standard they feel they must maintain without being harsh or cruel toward gay people.
Well, of course, again, Rodney, loving and welcoming everybody. Everybody, absolutely. I have no problem with that. And I'd be against what you described as condemnatory preaching. But that's different from teaching that explains the biblical views. And one of the things I'm really opposed to today, let's forget the gay issue for a moment. The issue is much wider than that. It's the philosophy of what's called social constructivism. In other words, everything we do is socially constructed. And they have three simple slogans. There are no givens, there are no rules, and there are no limits. Now, take the first one, there are no givens. The biblical view is there are certain givens. Even the Stoics believed in a natural order. But the idea today that everything is socially constructed is extremely radical. And I bet you everything I have that in 20, 25 years, the social chaos and the psychological confusion are going to be profound. So this is not a question of not accepting or condemning anyone. No, no. We've got to look. The Bible's concerned with the right way to know God and the right way to live in human societies. And the way the social constructionists and the way the sexual revolution at large is going is going to be disastrous, both on the heterosexual side and also on the homosexual side. And we've got to go much, much deeper in our discussions.
What do you make of that? Do you think that the trend towards, as it were, not there being no such thing as, gender fluidity, the fact that we make our own, as it were, choices about exactly who we are and what we are, do you think that's a good thing, or do you share any of the fears that Oz has over that?
It's not fears.
Well, not fears, concerns, let's say, of what that may mean for society in the long run.
I think we all want to be concerned about creating stable societies. We all want stability. We all want law and order. We all want the ability of everyone to rise. But I had a thought come to mind when he was speaking. Back in 1967, in 16 of our states in the United States, in the South, those that were formerly of the Confederacy, slave states, now Republican conservative states, it was illegal for black and white people to marry. And there was that famous case of the Loving family, the That was their last name, Loving. The white man and the black woman, they married, and it was illegal for them to marry, and they were going to be sentenced to jail. And the judge said, because God put the different races on different continents, and they should not get together in marital relationships, and he expelled them from the state of Virginia, in effect.
But Rodney,
I think that we do.
Horrendous.
I think
horrendous.
Yes,
but
it is
you know, my ancestor who founded the Guinness Brewery was a close friend of William Wilberforce. It was Christians in the name of people made in the image of God who fought for the abolition of slavery. But you always see when cultures are under stress, take the South, take sometimes Northern Ireland, take America as a whole. Cultures under stress use a conservative form of religion that distorts the religion in order to be a bastion, take South Africa and apartheid. It's always wrong. We couldn't agree with you more on something like that. That was horrendous, but that's not the biblical position.
So why doesn't God fix it? Why doesn't God intervene among those people who believe in him and fix it?
Well, he has intervened in Jesus, but let's put it like this. It's a longer discussion. God has made free, responsible human beings. He calls us, you know, what the Jews call tikkun, and that was to restore, repair the earth. Our job is to bring justice and freedom to people who are oppressed. So we've got to do something about that. And the Lord's made us instruments of his justice.
We are running out of time here, and it's been a really interesting conversation. Thank you, Rodney, for being part of it today. Do you feel like, that you could ever see yourself coming back to any form of Christian faith, Rodney? You're obviously, you haven't stepped completely away from belief in God. We can see that. Obviously, Oz is concerned, though, at the lab-coated deist God that you have sort of put your, you know, imagined in a sense that set the world in motion. Do you feel like anything could persuade you back to something like the view that Jesus really is God come in the flesh and he has loving purposes for the world?
At this point, I would want nothing to do with Christianity as it exists in conservative Republican America.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing. Christianity that exists beyond that, wonderful. I love the ideas. I love the stories. I love the thought of life after this life. I love the idea of closing my eyes the final time and opening them in the light with Jesus. Those are profoundly inspirational and beautiful thoughts that bring great solace to individuals. And I would expect that on my deathbed, I will be hoping to wake up in that world to come. But the way Christianity is practiced today, at least the conservative variety thereof in the United States, I would not want to be part of it.
Any thoughts as we close out yourself, Oz?
Well, I understand what he said there, but the key question, Rodney, is it true? That's the ultimate question. Now, I agree with you on 90% of your critiques, although it's not all on the right. There's a lot of it crazy on the left, too, but that's a question for another day. But with all that agreement, the question is it true? And that's the issue. And you've sort of skirted around with all the caricatures, many of which I agree with. You know, I've attacked those things in several books. You read my book, A Case for Civility, the chapter critiquing the Christian rights, far stronger than anything you said today.
Well, look, we're going to leave it there. Thank you so much, gents, both for being with me on the programme. It's been really great. And again, if you want to find out more about either Rodney or Oz in the books, Fool's Talk and Killing God, then simply go and to the website. You can find the links there at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. It's been a great pleasure to have you both on. And we should do this again at some point, Oz, when you're over and perhaps in the future too, Rodney. In the meantime, thanks for being with me. And we'll be hearing some feedback in just a moment's time as we continue with today's show.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, because we haven't had time for feedback, feedback in the last couple of weeks of programmes. I've got an absolutely bulging mailbag, a wodge of emails as thick as my arm here to try and get through. I'll get through as many as I can in what remains of the time. But as ever, if you'd like to comment on today's programme and you'd like to get in touch, why not email me, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. And you can get in touch via the Facebook, Twitter accounts as well, at UnbelievableJB to follow me on Twitter. Facebook.com/UnbelievableJB is the Facebook page of the show. All of those addresses and more available from the website, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Here's Jeff in Canada who says, "Hi Justin, just wanted to take a minute to wish you and your team a happy 10th anniversary. I pray the programme continues to give a platform for open debate on the issues of faith as people pursue the truth of who and why they are." Stephen says, "Wanted to say I really appreciated the show. It was interesting hearing your reflections on how the programme has developed over time. I especially enjoyed hearing about your own journey and how the debates have helped develop, solidify and refine your own views. I really connected with your comments about the place of reason and how that doesn't necessarily trump experience. There is knowing about Christ and then there is knowing Christ." Thank you very much indeed, Stephen. Ben in Rochester, Michigan says, "Really enjoyed the 10th anniversary show. I've listened to all the back episodes and enjoyed the memories you chose to play. I can certainly say your show has greatly helped me and encouraged my faith in many ways. I don't recall who they were on with, but the shows with Richard Borkham and also Tim McGrew have been tremendous faith strengtheners. On the other hand, the frequent visits from Bart Ehrman have been the most disturbing. However, after listening to him so many times, you do begin to realise it's more his confident manner of presenting what are often completely false assertions that is so persuasive. As a result, I think I've become less vulnerable to other convincing presenters. The concern about damaging people's faith is, I believe, overstated. Jesus has assured us that his sheep know his voice and the Father will not allow them to be snatched out of his hand. If anyone finds the presentation of counter-arguments devastating to their faith, then they may not have had the faith to begin with, or they may need to be rocked in their faith in order to dig deeper to come to a stronger faith. Either way, the truth will always be used by God to accomplish good, and your program is about seeking truth. I just want to thank you for providing a ministry that's certainly a huge influence in my own life and undoubtedly presents the gospel to more unbelievers than almost any other ministry I can think of, and in ways that are most likely to remove obstacles for those who are being called by the Lord. You're a beloved brother, Justin." Thank you, Ben. Brother Ben. And this one from Avril says, "My Saturdays wouldn't be the same without Unbelievable. I point as many as possible to listen. Has made such a difference to my walk with Christ. So many good books and authors, John Lennox, Alistair McGrath, inspiring and uplifting. The church is in great need of inspiration in today's world with all we are facing. Armchair Christianity won't work. We are, whether we like it or not, soldiers in a battle for the minds and souls. And we need our armour and ammunition. Keep up the great work, Justin." Thank you very much, Avril. This one from Rob Sharp on Facebook says, "I've been binge listening to your show. I travel extensively and you've helped me enjoy numerous hours. Today, it was your ISIS debate while in California on the train." Well done, and thank you. Well, we'll see if we can squeeze in some responses to that ISIS debate in a moment, Rob. Finally, just in terms of the birthday greetings, this one comes from Andy, who says, "My name is Andy White. I'm a physician, a college professor and pastor of a church in Kentucky. I'm a gigantic fan of Unbelievable and of your apologetic work. I'm a converted atheist myself, converted to theism by apologetic arguments. I began listening to your show when I was in seminary in 2009. After practicing medicine for 15 years, I went back to Asbury Theological Seminary and became obsessed with your show. Your topics are profound and relevant and the format brilliant. I've had many angry Saturday mornings when there were no show for some reason. My wife will tell you, listening to your show is the highlight of my Saturday morning now for years. I believe I've heard every show you've recorded. I'm particularly interested in faith science issues and religious epistemology as it relates to worldviews. So I started a podcast myself, along with a physicist, Doug, from my congregation, regarding issues of faith, science interface and worldview. Our format and focus is different from your show, but it does cross over regarding apologetics. The two of us interview a scholar on a particular issue, such as God and cosmology, or science and the soul, neuroscience of consciousness, etc. And then we discuss it after the interview from a Christian perspective and a science. We're starting to take off a bit and gain an audience, but it obviously takes time. We're primarily on iTunes and YouTube. The show is called God Talk and can also be found under Dr. Andy and Doug on YouTube." And you finish off by saying, "I've been wanting to contact you for some time to thank you for the show, as it has a major impact on my life and I've promoted it much for years. I also thought it would be cool to have you come on our show as a guest to discuss your personal thoughts on a few apologetics issues." Well, we'll see what we can do, Andy, but it was lovely to get that email and to hear how much you've enjoyed the show and how much relevance it's had. So we don't have much time left for for some of the many, many other emails we've had on both the recent programmes, both the one we did on ISIS and whether ISIS is Islamic. That provoked a lot of response in the wake of the Paris attacks. But also the podcast-only edition of the programme of a couple of weeks ago when I put out on the podcast feed the debate between David Robertson and Michael Nugent on the question of whether Christianity is holding Northern Ireland back. So we might have to have some of those a bit later. But here's one from Haig Shishmanian from Allendale in New Jersey, USA, on the Is ISIS Islamic episode. Now, you may remember this was two Christian guests and two Muslim guests debating this. Jeremiah Johnston and Craig Evans, the authors of Jesus and the Jihadis. And on the Islamic side, we had Inayat Bunglawala and Adnan Rashid. So Haig says, I've religiously listened to every episode of your show since I discovered it earlier this year. Huge fan and student of the ministry. As a Middle Eastern Christian, I'm an ethnic Armenian with parents from Iran and Lebanon, having lived in Turkey myself for 3 years. I'm particularly concerned with bridging the practical theological gap between Christ's command to love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, and the responsibility to protect one's family community from helpful and unhelpful ideologies. I greatly appreciated this week's topic and how it parsed out some of the key points of dissonance between Christian orthodoxy and fundamentalist Islam. I do, however, admit to finding myself tired and dissatisfied by the thoughts posed by both Christian and Muslim guests. The Christians seem to continually read the Quran without regard for its historical context, in ways they wouldn't want non-Christians to do with the Old Testament, e.g. picking out violent words and weighing them against the Bible and the New Testament. The Muslim guests, on the other hand, seem to tiptoe around the gruesome details from the Quran and Hadith brought up by the Christians in the conversation, relying on sort of an egalitarian leveling of the playing field that to me simply seems like smoke and mirrors in an effort to avoid the real crux of the matter. I may have a bias, as I am heavily invested in reading up on this topic, but I am tired of the old back and forth on whether the Quran advocates violence, especially when involving two opposite ends of the spectrum. I can't read all of your email here, Haig, but you say, I would greatly appreciate hearing a conversation between Christians with different missiological approaches towards and thoughts on Islam. Have a down and dirty conversation about how Christians should respond, especially to the influx of Muslim refugees from the Middle East. Might I suggest considering the points raised in one of Nabil Jabour's books? Relevant, of course, in light of these fairly inflammatory comments by Donald Trump in the USA about closing borders to Muslims and so on, which, to be honest, I haven't seen any evangelical Christian leader agree with him about, even though he does claim to have the backing of a lot of evangelicals in the States, obviously. Thank you very much, anyway, for getting in touch. This one from Doja Omikorede said, please ask our Muslim panelists if there are 1.5 billion Muslims in the world, and for the sake of argument, there are just 500 ISIS Muslims. What is the majority of 1.5 billion, less just 500, doing to curb the wanton destruction going on? Evil abounds because good people keep quiet. Prayson says, hi Justin, I'm a fan from Copenhagen, Denmark. I love the show, listen to almost all the programs. Given the last podcast, I made a profile of terror groups in the last 2 decades that have taken more than 1,000 lives. Sadly, Islamic fostered groups take more than 90%. So you've given a link to that as well. Thank you very much, Prayson, for that suggestion. Ian Mackey says, a fascinating show on ISIS, very well chaired. As a Christian, I have to admit I had more sympathy for the two Muslim guests than the Christians. Jeremiah Johnston and Craig Evans may well have done very valuable work in explaining the Islamic roots of ISIS and the underlying thinking of the movement, but then to say that ISIS is the true Islam was rather unfair and unhelpful. Now, I believe Islam is completely wrong. There's no comparison between Jesus and Muhammad. Islam completely misunderstands the Trinity, and the two Muslims did paint a rather rosy picture of Islamic nations, to say the least. We do well to remember that our battle is not against flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers. Happy 10th birthday to Unbelievable. Thank you, Ian. Sam in Cincinnati, Ohio says, I'm a firm believer in non-violence and devoted follower of Jesus of Nazareth, and tend to agree with your Muslim guests that ISIS is not Islamic. Your Muslim guests seem to have something in common with the Muslims I know personally. They are peace-seeking, loving people. The reason I don't consider ISIS a religion is because I've taken a liberty with how one defines religion. I add the word peace
into the official definition. Religion is an organized system of belief, ceremonies, and rules used to worship a god of peace or a group of gods of peace. I also redefine a cult as a group of people having religious beliefs or practices that are sinister or evil. It seemed all your guests agree that ISIS is evil, so by my definition, it's a very large cult. Thank you very much. You say that you agree that the KKK and other similar supposedly Christian groups are also cults and fall in the same category, therefore, as ISIS. Thank you very much. Here's one quickly from Laurie in Santa Cruz, California. Laurie felt Craig and Jeremiah were heavy-handed in saying ISIS is the most accurate expression of Islam. Evangelicals often approach Islam using the same hermeneutics they use for the Bible and the Christian faith. This leads them to believe that the Islamists, who use the most literal interpretation of the Quran, must be interpreting it correctly. But the last thing we should do is affirm the ISIS interpretation of Islam and write off countless Islamic scholars who interpret it differently. However, I also think Adnan and Iniat should have acknowledged that there is a serious problem in Islam instead of deflecting blame. And the problem in Islam comes precisely because of the difficulty in interpreting the Quran. The Quran itself provides little or no context for its verses, unlike the Bible, which includes huge amount of context within its pages. And let's call this the final one, I think, on this, because we're running out of time. This is from David, who says, I think your Muslim guest might have been pressed more on what is true Islam. Is not the goal of true Islam the enforcement of Sharia law over all the world? If not, what is it? Your guest could have been pressed more on that. Does it include freedom of speech, freedom of religion, equal rights of women? Your guests did not say. One might think that Saudi Arabia ought to be the model of true Islam, but there it's illegal to be an atheist. Women are not allowed outside without a male relative, and the youth is facing execution for taking part in a demonstration. In Egypt, 86% of Muslims support the death penalty for conversion away from Islam. Coptic girls get kidnapped and raped with no help from the police. Sudan recently condemned a Christian woman to death for apostasy. Asia Bibi is still on the death row in Pakistan for alleged blasphemy. In Indonesia, church burning carries on apace and the authorities do nothing to stop it. So you say, maybe true Islam is, after all, just attending the mosque, doing the Hajj and praying five times a day. If so, we can all rest easy. But we will then remain a little puzzled why so many young Muslims read their Qurans and conclude that only ISIS takes the holy book seriously and flock to it. Anyway, just a selection of the response we had to that show. We'll try and include some of the response to the one with David Robertson and Michael Nugent as well in next time's programme. For the moment, thank you very much for being with me here on the show that aims to get you thinking, and we'll hopefully continue to do that for another 10 years at least. I'm going to be handing over now to Sam Hales on The Profile, who's going to be speaking to Jonathan Sandys, the great-grandson, believe it or not, of Winston Churchill. All that remains for me to do is tell you what's coming up on this programme next week.
You're unbelievable.
I'm pleased to have Peter Hitchens back in studio with me. Peter Hitchens is a Mail on Sunday columnist, very forthright in his views on society, culture, and of course his own Christian faith. He's going to be debating with an atheist representative the recent report that came out on religion and belief in British public life. That recommended sweeping reforms that effectively would take Christianity out of the public sphere in various ways, and we're going to be hearing his response and others on that programme. Same time next week. Until then, have a great week, and I'll see you then.
When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at remarkable.com today.